Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, CMS hears public comments on their proposed budget for next year, and the public says they want more funding. Governor Cooper calls for a big raise for teachers and another for state employees. Senate leader Phil Berger says he's open to such a move. The state Supreme Court Chief Justice shuffles the deck at the district court level here. Elizabeth Trosh is out. Roy Wiggins is in as Mecklenburg's chief district court judge. We'll tell you what happened. A resolution in an election protest in state district or Senate District 41, and Katz looks for ways to make the Gold Line streetcar more reliable. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV and host of The Political Beat on Sunday mornings. Nick Oxner is WBTV's executive producer for investigations and chief investigative reporter. And Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for The Charlotte Observer. Good morning and welcome to you all. Don't everybody morning. Talk at once. Good morning. Thank you very much. All right, let's start where we normally finish. With the Panthers, the NFL draft began last night. The Panthers weren't supposed to pick until the second round tonight, and lo and behold, they made a deal yesterday with Buffalo.
The Buffalo Bills have traded the 32nd pick to the Carolina Panthers. With the 32nd pick in the 2024 NFL draft, the Carolina Panthers select Xavier Leggett, wide receiver, South Carolina.
Well, that's a surprise. I would think it's a surprise. Is it a surprise?
Panthers were looking to make a deal, and there are some advantages to them trading into the first round now that they got this guy who is really good. He is going to be a great addition to the team. They can get a fifth-year option on his contract, whereas they wouldn't have been able to have that perk if they waited one more pick and picked him at 33 instead of 32, but he is a great receiver. He's one of a few to have 1,000 receiving yards for Carolina. He's kind of local. He's from Mullins, which is east of Marion, northwest of a town called Ketchup Town, fun fact. and he is going to fit right in. They've got a bunch of weapons now for Bryce Young, and hopefully this is the start of something special for them.
That was NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell making that announcement. Of course, here's Panthers coach Dave Canales.
Versatility is huge for us. So when you get a guy who can really run, a guy who can high point the ball, a guy that can carry it, and you can give him the ball different ways. He just brings a lot of versatility. Now, with that being said, he's got a long way to go. He's got to learn our stuff. He's got to, figure out the system.
Now, during his pre-draft press conference, new general manager Dan Morgan said that the players that have been added in the offseason means the team won't have to be desperate for a particular player in the draft.
I feel we addressed a lot of needs in free agency, and I think that will, set us up nicely during the draft to, allow us to draft the best player available.
So we had the 33rd and the 39th picks. We traded for the 32nd. Not desperate, Joe, but smart?
Yeah, I think it is smart. Already a bunch of receivers came off the board in the first round, and this was an opportunity to get a guy they wanted and now have him under control for a longer period of time. They did add many different weapons during the offseason, so they weren't entering the draft too stressed out, like Deontay Johnson, for example, at wide receiver. They rebuilt the line. I think he is going to fit in really well.
So Joe is a Panthers fan, so we must now turn to an absolutely unbiased analysis of this from Mary Ramsey, who just happens to be a University of South Carolina alumnus. So she has no dog in this race at all. Mary, go ahead.
Not at all. Yeah. First of all, I need to correct the record a little bit. Commissioner Goodell did not do a great job with Xavier's name. It's Xavier
right.
Leggett. So I'm sure we'll all learn that here in Charlotte. But yeah, having watched him play, I think 5 years in a Gamecock uniform, he has consistently grown by leaps and bounds every season, finishing up with just a fantastic senior year alongside Spencer Rattler, our best receiver by far, really a unique blend of speed and size, those intangible things that you can't teach, has proven to really be a sponge with our coaching staff. So I think it'll be a really great fit here in Charlotte, and excited to see my guy staying in the Carolinas.
So we get the 39th pick tonight. That'll make it early in the evening, I think, unless something changes. What do we anticipate here tonight? Joe?
We'll see where they go with this. They need some more weapons on defense now that they kind of rebuilt the offense for Bryce Young, grabbing this young wide receiver. They are looking pretty good on the line, so now I think they'll take a focus on defense. But they did the most they could without having that first pick in the draft because Nick Spears got it from the pass deal that we did, and it's going to be a long journey. It's not going to be a Super Bowl run next year, likely, but this was a good first step.
Meanwhile, new head coach Dave Canales says he's dividing his time between the voluntary mini camp, which is underway this week, and staying involved in draft plans.
It really is cool, though, to be out there on the field right now, to see plays happening, to imagine, different players in the draft and how they would fit in with the actual bodies and the guys that we have there.
So are all of you optimistic? I mean, you just kind of talked about we won't be going to the Super Bowl this year, but that things will get better. So I'm just curious. I know you're all on FanDuel. How are you betting on this?
The
I
way
am
you
not
work that
going to
in
be
was
putting
so
money on
seamless,
the
Mike.
Panthers.
Thank you. Excuse me, Joe. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying I'm not going to be putting money on the Panthers anytime soon.
Okay, but you can bet on anything. All right, Governor Roy Cooper released his proposed budget this week as legislators returned to Raleigh for their short session. Given the GOP supermajority, Steve, is that budget dead on arrival?
I mean, it's kind of a I mean, yes, in a way that the legislature does not need to listen to him or take into account what he's asked for. He has called for I believe, an 8.5% raise for teachers, which would increase the starting pay to about $48,000, which would be the highest in the Southeast. He's also called for a $2.5 billion school construction bond. The bond was one that very clearly the Republicans rejected outright. Phil Berger said that they just aren't in the business of assuming more debt. So whereas there will be raises for state employees and teachers, that'll be a back and forth. The bond appears to be dead.
That $2.5 billion bond proposal, that's the same amount that CMS, isn't it? The same amount that CMS bond was last November that we just did for one district. So even if they said yes to this $2.5 billion bond, it's statewide. How much could it pay for?
I think I read 90 new elementary and middle schools. So, right. I mean, to your point, Mecklenburg County is about a tenth of the state. So that $2.5 billion would be spread very thin over all of North Carolina.
Given the legislature's general sentiments about expanding these opportunity scholarships, which they've been doing so that students can go to schools other than the public schools, does it seem likely, does it make sense for them to pass a bond of that amount to build public schools?
I think the bigger issue is not so much between the private school vouchers and public schools. I think the bigger issue is philosophically that they don't want to take on the debt that the
Okay.
bond would incur. That's my take on it.
And these opportunity scholarships, which are controversial in some circles, may end up being a flashpoint in these budget talks. The legislature has already expanded those vouchers to anybody who wants them, but demand has outstripped supply, so they're coming into this short session considering adding $300 million to that program. And here's how Governor Cooper described that move.
Republican legislative leaders are promising to give away hundreds of millions more just to make sure that the wealthier North Carolinians can pick up their government checks for children that they already have in private school.
That's just one thing these vouchers do, but that is a criticism that's been raised, especially since the less affluent children who get these scholarships still won't have enough money to attend most private schools. They'll have to fund the difference, and they probably won't be able to. So is Cooper's argument going to fall on deaf ears? Are they just ready to go with these opportunity scholarships?
I think ready to go is is the correct answer there, that this is a big priority for the legislature, that there was a huge demand for the private school vouchers, that the money ran out last year. So yes, I think more is coming, and the governor and Democrats will protest, but this is one where they don't have much leverage at all.
So as you already pointed out, the governor is proposing these pay raises for teachers and for state employees, 8.5% for teachers, I think 5% for state employees. It puts the teacher starting teacher pay raise to somewhere in the neighborhood of $47,500, $48,000, plus retention bonuses. And Senate Leader Phil Berger didn't say no outright.
I'm not opposed to us looking at salaries for teachers and state employees.
So state employees already will receive 3% raises this fall. How likely, despite what Phil Berger just said, how likely are these proposals to be fully funded?
I mean, here's the thing. Nothing in the governor's budget is going to become reality, right? It's all going to be whatever the man you just heard from, Senate Leader Phil Berger, wants and whatever he can get through the House. That being said, we continue to hear, one, from teachers that need more pay, but more importantly, we continue to hear from agencies across state government that they can't keep qualified workers because their pay just is not competitive. And that's, you hear that from Republican council state agency heads and people in the governor's cabinet. So it'll be interesting to see if they get a bigger boost to state employees.
And to put an exclamation point on how the Senate leader and probably the House leadership feels about the budget coming from the governor's office, Berger did say that he didn't have time to carefully review the governor's budget proposal. But he told reporters, if you boil this proposal down, it's always spend more, tax more. Is that a fair analysis?
Compared to a proposal that Phil Berger would put forward, sure. But I think that's a nice talking point for the Republican leader there.
But do you have to tax more when you have a billion-dollar plus surplus?
And that's what they would point to and say, you know, we don't need to raise tax. Although Berger, even more so than his House Republican colleagues, right, who want to spend more always, and that's what we've seen the fights between the House and Senate on over the last few budgets, Berger is always reticent to add new recurring spending because he's afraid that you're going to get out one day where you don't have a budget surplus and then you do have to raise taxes. And so, you know, he's arguably the most conservative fiscally, even compared to the folks on the other side of the General Assembly.
Given that the governor is a lame duck because he's term limited by law, and we have two new candidates running for governor, Josh Stein on the Democratic side and Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson on the Republican side, shouldn't these comments about these proposals be coming from them?
No. So, you know, this, and let's keep in mind, this is just the short session. We already have a biennial budget, a budget that covers 2 years, and that was passed in the long session last year. So the short session is really to come in, true up the budget, see where we're at with money and dollars and needs, and do anything else that really needs to be done right now. But this typically, unless there's some hijinks going on, you're not going to see any major policy proposals pass. So yes, we will see a new budget proposal next year from whoever the new governor is at the start of the long session. And because this is how North Carolina operates with a weak governor, it'll be ignored by the General Assembly.
How long is the short session? Because I remember one short session being particularly long. How long is it scheduled to be?
They'd probably like to be out of here no later than 4th of July, but as soon as possible. They all want to go home.
Okay, when we come back, another budget to take a look at, the CMS budget, which was released. And then we'll talk about the resolution of an election protest in North Carolina Senate District 41, which is in Mecklenburg County. District judge shakeup and maneuvers at Katz. And the red line, and the gold line, you name it, whatever color you want to make it. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. It's the local news roundup. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison, political reporter for WFAE News. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter at the Charlotte Observer. Nick Oxner is the chief investigative reporter at WBTV. And Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSSC-TV and host of their Political Beat, seen on Sunday mornings on Channel 9. While we're talking about budgets, let's talk a moment about the CMS budget. Their request for funding from the Mecklenburg County Commission is for $660.4 million. That is an increase, at least according to our Andos Helms here at WFAE, of more than $63 million. But Superintendent Crystal Hill says the number is closer to $35 million. Why the discrepancy?
I've gone over this, and all in how it's being counted, and when you look at one-time money and recurring money, and so I think the $35 million is the request for an increase in recurring funds that would be baked into the future budgets going forward. And if I mess that up, I'm sure someone will text me angrily about it.
Okay, CMS began conducting, CMS began conducting public hearings on their budget proposal this week. Some of what they heard from the public, I would think, would be encouraging to them. They seem to be on their side in terms of more funding. What did they hear?
Yeah, you know, I think generally the public is in favor of more funding for teachers, and actually a lot of the increase would actually go towards increasing teacher pay and pay for support staff. We also, you know, are dealing with now the end of all the COVID money that helped bolster CMS budgets and all really state and local budgets for the last several years. So I think people do want to see an increase in teacher pay specifically.
We had members of the county commission on this program this week, and this came up, obviously. They were noncommittal to talk about where they come down on this because they haven't taken this up yet, nor has it come from county manager Dina DiOrio. When does that happen?
CMS is scheduled to present their budget to county commission on May 8th.
Okay.
But keep in mind, Mike, when we talk about the debate between the funding request from the school board and what the county wants to give, it's not much of a debate anymore because of a law that was passed by the General Assembly like 5 or 6 years ago. If you recall the last big funding fight we had in Mecklenburg County a few years ago, it ended with basically the school district getting what they wanted because by law, they'd get what they wanted anyways, eventually.
And on Monday, we will spend the hour on this program with CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill and the CFO, the Chief Financial Officer at CMS, to talk about this budget. We'll go through it little by little, piece by piece, on Monday at 9. Before we move away from schools, there was yet another gun discovered at CMS schools this week, or a CMS school this week. It was unloaded, but it was in the possession of a fourth grader at Devonshire Elementary School on Barrington Drive in East Charlotte. What else do we know about this incident?
Not much, and not for lack of trying. My colleague at The Observer, Joe Marusak, reported on this. As you said, the gun was found in a student's bag, an elementary school student. It was reported to school staff by another student initially, but Joe unfortunately has not been able to get much further information from Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police or CMS. He has asked questions about where and how the student got the weapon, whether any adults will face charges related to this incident, and has not been able to get an answer as of yet.
Because of that case, and I've forgotten which state he was in, but where both parents were charged because their son went into a school and they were convicted because their son went into a school and killed some students and staff, should people be thinking twice about locking up their guns and keeping them away from their... Because CMPD reported this gun is worth $300, and yet it was in the possession of a fourth grader. They didn't buy it.
Yeah, I'm by no means a legal expert, but having heard from gun safety advocates in the past, I think, you know, that's critically important for parents and guardians who do choose to have something like this in their home to make sure that it's not in a place where children, particularly young children that may not fully understand what can happen when you use something like that. Yeah. Incredibly careful about access.
Those convictions took place in the state of Michigan, by the way. Last March, Democrat Lucille Puckett, who was the second place finisher in the state Senate District 41 contest in Charlotte, filed an election protest alleging that her opponent, Democrat Caleb how do you say it, Joe?
Tedros,
or Caleb Tedros, didn't meet the residency requirements. And in a hearing held by the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections this week, Puckett laid out why she believed her opponent did not meet those requirements.
Every piece of evidence points to a clear and deliberate attempt to circumvent the residency requirements.
But Tedros provided documentation of a full lease at his apartment, which began last June, and he also took issue with an allegation that he moved after the fact.
The district was not drawn until about October. I moved in July. So even this idea that I moved for this purpose is incorrect.
So there is this requirement that candidates for state senate live in the state for at least 2 years and live in the district for at least 1 year prior to the election. Why did Lucille Puckett make this allegation? What made her believe that something was amiss here?
Well, I pulled his voter registration history, and he didn't officially register to vote in that Plaza Midwood apartment until late November. So by the time he registered to vote, it was past the 1 year mark that he needs in order to be eligible
Is that the benchmark, the registering to vote, or is the benchmark signing a lease and moving in?
No, it's not the first thing most people do is register to vote when they move to a new location. And the State Board of Elections takes that into account. The guy, Mr. Tedros, presented a lease. He presented affidavits from his dad and his girlfriend who he lives with. He presented DoorDash receipts showing all of the times that he ordered food to that apartment. And it was pretty substantial. The board agreed, and they voted to dismiss the protest 5-0. It's worth looking into when you have the change in voter registration so late. But Tedros had more than enough proof that he actually established residency in July.
And Mecklenburg County Elections Board member Mary Potter Suma asked Lucille Puckett if she had any photographic evidence that her opponent was still living at his parents' old address.
Do you like pictures or any other evidence showing he's physically there?
No.
You don't have that? Okay.
And Suma added,
in the past, when we dealt with this issue, we've had evidence presented of the person at the location where they claim to live but don't.
So is it the combination of that lack of evidence and the preponderance of evidence that Mr. Tedros provided what led to this unanimous decision to keep the vote as it was?
That's how it sounded in the room. A couple of the key pieces of evidence that Lucille Puckett had presented included a certified letter that she had mailed to Tedros's previous address, which he has said is his parents' home. The letter was signed for, but was not actually signed for by Mr. Tedros. Shown a picture of the letter at the hearing, Mr. Tedros said that it was not his signature on the certified letter, but that it very well could be his father, and that like a lot of young adults who have moved frequently, he does have some mail just sent to his parents' home, and his parents simply save it for him and give it to him the next time he comes over. She also, another thing that came up during this hearing that was new, Mr. Tedros alleged that he had reported to CMPD that he had found a GPS tracker in his car. He asked Lucille Puckett during cross-examination about this because she had said earlier in the hearing that she had hired a private investigator to look into him. He questioned her about whether that hiring could be related to the GPS tracker. She said that she paid for a service but had no idea about anything related to a GPS tracker and had no involvement in that.
After this unanimous decision was handed down by the Elections Board, which was not in Lucille Puckett's favor, she made this statement to Queen City News.
All of the evidence that was there, still kind of disappointing to know that they didn't follow the letter of the law.
So on what is she basing that claim? They didn't follow the letter of the law.
She's claimed that she did not get a fair hearing the first time she went before the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections. When she initially went to them and said, I want to have a hearing about this, they did not grant her one. The State Board of Elections overturned that, saying she did have enough probable cause to get this evidentiary hearing. And she has repeatedly said, but not really been able to give specifics, that basically she thinks the Mecklenburg County Board went into that initial hearing and went into the second hearing this week with a predetermined decision in mind. fine. But again, they have said over and over again that the preponderance of evidence simply goes in Mr. Tedros's favor.
So does this decision now end this?
Lucille Puckett does plan to appeal to the State Board of Elections. They ruled in her favor on the last appeal, but given the amount of evidence that Mr. Tedros was able to present at this evidentiary hearing, everyone I've spoken to feels that the State Board will probably rule in his favor.
So there was a shakeup this week on Mecklenburg County District Court when the State Supreme Court Chief Justice Paul Newby named a new Chief District Court Judge here. He removed Judge Elizabeth Trosh, who's been the Chief Judge there for quite a while, replacing her with Judge Roy Wiggins. Why?
We haven't heard specifically from Mr. Newby just yet on why he is making the move. Certainly, there have been some issues recently in Mecklenburg County Court. Trosh was tasked with overseeing the implementation of Portal, of Odyssey, the new electronic court system. We have a backlog of cases. We also know she's been really active in the community. Just a couple of weeks ago, she was speaking before Charlotte City Council about the ordinances that impact people who are homeless. We know that she's been talking about policies for setting bonds for certain crimes. But until we hear from Newby, we don't specifically know why this replacement is happening.
And it would be safe to say, would it not, that this was not political. Paul Newby is a Republican, Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court. Elizabeth Trosh is a Democrat, but then so is Roy Wiggins. So politics probably didn't play into it. It was the factors that you just mentioned. When might Paul Newby tell us why? Or will we
he may never tell us why. And it, also, this comes after Judge Trosh has been the subject of quiet and not so quiet grumbling from lawyers who practice primarily in district court for quite some time. And there was grumbling when she was appointed to this position initially. So I think it's, I wonder why, what precipitated this move now, but it's not surprising in the arc of public sentiment about Judge Trosh at the courthouse.
Okay. After years of saying no to using its tracks for the Red Line commuter train from Davidson to Uptown, there appears to have been some softening in recent months of that position by Norfolk Southern. But Mary, you report this week that this is nowhere close to being a done deal and that perhaps lingering distrust could scuttle the plans. Talk about that.
Yeah, so that not a done deal at all was a direct quote from one of our North Mecklenburg mayors who also serves on the Metropolitan Transit Commission. I should say the most of the leaders and residents of North Mecklenburg that I talked to about this project were excited that there seemed to be some movement. I met with most of them at a public meeting held by Katz at the Huntersville Library last week, where community members had the opportunity to look over the plan as it stands now for the Red Line, offer their feedback on potential changes, and many were excited to do that. That being said, pretty much everyone told me, you know, this isn't the first time that we've gotten our hopes up, and we've sort of learned to tamper these hopes until something is firmly in place, which is not the case yet. Norfolk Southern has come to the table. That's good news for people who want the Red Line, but it's not a done deal. Additionally, multiple elected officials, including Mecklenburg County Commissioner Elaine Powell, who represents much of North Mecklenburg, told me that they really want to see a strong agreement and a lot of unity between all of the Mecklenburg County leaders, all of those mayors and county commission, before we move forward, so that there's a very clear-cut plan that will be fair to the residents of North Mecklenburg who are, under the original transit agreement passed in the late 90s, paying tax money into the CAT system but don't feel like they're really getting the service that they've been promised over the years.
And they promised in those North Mecklenburg towns that if a vote comes up for more taxes for transportation, unless they get the Red Line, they're voting no, and they will encourage their citizens to vote no on that. So there is something riding on this, not to make a pun. But you pointed out these public hearings. This plan was devised for the Red Line in 2008. That was, 16 years ago. And things have changed. And so they've spent millions of dollars to have a consultant redesign the red line, rethink the stops, add stops, maybe subtract stops. And they're trotting this new version out to residents to get public comment. This is going on even as skepticism over Norfolk Southern's true intent here to use the O-line, as they call it, may or may not happen. Is this kind of like putting the cart before the horse, to mix transportation metaphors?
Yeah, CAT staff told me that, obviously, like you just said, this is a plan that's sort of been sitting stagnant for a while now, and a lot has changed. And they simply want to be prepared so that if and when things do move forward, they're sort of ready to go. A lot of folks I talked to mentioned a lot about maybe moving or changing stops. If a lot of people are interested in the idea of, for example, putting a stop at or near Camp North End, which obviously was not really a thing when this was originally designed. People expressed all kinds of ideas. Multiple people, this was something I hadn't really heard before, but heard at the public meeting, were interested in seeing CATS change the name because of the historical connotations about redlining and the fact that the tracks do go through an historically Black neighborhood in Huntersville. Residents of that neighborhood are not necessarily opposed to the red line itself, but they don't love the name given those historical connotations. So a lot of different things for CATS planners to consider and sort of chew on.
Steve, one of the other pieces of feedback apparently that they're getting in these public meetings is that people were asked to choose how they would use this if it came to pass. And the most popular choices were for retail shopping and leisure and to get uptown for sporting events and concerts and things like this. This is called the Red Line Commuter Line. Have things changed that much since the pandemic? Is that what's going on here?
You know, that's an interesting response, because the original plan for the train was that it was going to just basically run at rush hour. I mean, right, maybe a couple trips at midday. Now, CATS is talking about having more frequent service throughout the day. That will, of course, make it more expensive to run. But I mean, it seems like that's a stretch. That, you know, it's hard to envision the train ever running more than 20 minutes, you know, every 20 minutes, mm-hmm, that people would use that for retail, especially when there is really no retail uptown. I mean, you know, like, you just, it's not going to do much for you. So,
but it could be people from uptown wanting to go to Huntersville
to go to Birkdale. Yeah,
that's right. All right. When we come back, there's a little more CATS news to talk about with regard to the streetcar. And then we are going to take a look at some possible fee hikes that the Mecklenburg County Commission is considering. And we'll get an update on the wilderness camp where a young boy, a 12-year-old boy, died in February, and an update on the Madalena Kojikari case and more as well when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Nick Oxner from WBTV, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, and WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison, who also spends a lot of his time covering CATS. And Steve, you reported this week that CATS is looking for ways to make the Gold Line streetcar more reliable, even as it plans for a possible extension along the Bates Ford Road corridor and Central Avenue through Plaza Midwood. Remind us, what seems to be the problem with reliability?
Mike, I think that one of the big challenges is that, you know, people park their cars, you know, on the existing line, and they stick out. They don't park well, or they park in the wrong place and they block the train. And because the streetcar isn't a bus, it can't go around them. It, you know, that gums up the whole system. So CATS is planning to build 6 more miles of the streetcar. They're trying to figure out ways to make it more reliable when they do that. One of the ideas they have is to try and put the rails in the inside lanes as close together, as far away from parked cars as they can. I assume there's places they can do that and maybe places they can't, but you know, the streetcars had a lot of troubles, but CATS is undeterred. I mean, they are moving forward with more than doubling the line if they can.
Yeah, streetcar project manager Jim Fetchula, I think that's how you say his name, he laid out some suggestions, like you just mentioned, building the rails on the inside lanes away from parked cars, which sometimes obstruct the Gold Line, or giving streetcars priority while moving through intersections with streetlights.
Our focus is going to be on runtime and reliability. It's definitely the feedback that I've received. I think, you know, people are telling us, we love the service. It's a clean service. The cars are great. The stops are great. We just need to get there more frequently.
In the meantime, they're thinking about extending this while ridership is down. Both ridership on Katz and Lynx is still below pre-pandemic levels, but has begun to rise on the buses and the Lynx Blue Line train. Streetcar has not recovered. Is that because of these reliability issues, do you think?
It's part of that. It's also because there was a long period where they only ran the streetcar, I believe, every 30 minutes because they didn't have enough people driving it. And so, you know, it's only a 4-mile line. And so if you have to wait 30 minutes and you're only going to go a mile and a half, it really doesn't make a lot of sense. They're now running them more frequently. I assume more people will start riding it. But, you know, just going back one more thing, we talked about those reliability issues like parked cars and things. These were all talked about 10, 15 years ago. I mean, this should not be a surprise. You know, the skeptics or the critics of the plan kind of pointed these things out. And, you know,
we're not one of the only cities in the world to have streetcars. And in fact, we had streetcars years ago. What's the deal with people parking in the streetcar right of way, blocking the car from moving? What's the deal with that?
It's a good question. I mean, I was parking on in Elizabeth a few weeks ago, and you know, it's a couple of the places are tight. I mean, it was fine if you just follow the rules and stay within the lines, but I guess there's enough people who just park just sloppy, bad parkers.
Yeah, it goes back to when you were a kid. Stay within the lines when you're coloring. Joe, go ahead.
Well, some of this is due to the proliferation of food delivery apps, and there are a lot of restaurants along the lines. So a lot of times DoorDash drivers or other rideshare drivers think that they can just quickly hop out of their car, run into Hooters. I witnessed this personally, pick up a to-go order, and just leave their car in the middle of the tracks, and it just annoys the heck out of the streetcar operators and everyone behind the streetcar.
And as you mentioned, Steve, maybe increasing the frequency would pick up ridership, more reliable service would pick up ridership. At least that's what Katz interim CEO Brent Cagle told the Metropolitan Transit Commission.
So we do believe that as people start to better understand that the headways have now been reduced, so better service, we will start to see those declines in the Gold Line decrease and ultimately turn into increases.
Are they going to wait for them to see if this works to increase reliability and ridership before they move on extending it?
No, I don't. I think the answer is no. I mean, we've got a long way to go. They don't have the money to extend it, so we would need the penny sales tax increase to do that. But Katz has never really decided that ridership is a key factor in whether to expand. The decision is just to expand, and then hopefully ridership will increase. But I've never heard them say, we will do this if ridership increases. I've just never heard that kind of stipulation.
Mecklenburg County, Mary, the Mecklenburg County Commission heard from several different departments this week about proposed fee increases for things like stormwater, development, solid waste. Residential property owners would see their monthly county stormwater service fees increased by 9 to 39 cents per month. Doesn't sound like a lot, but why do they need to increase it?
Yeah, so basically, this is the stormwater specifically, as well as the solid waste fee increases, are tied to a 15-year plan that we're currently in the middle of by that county department, really aimed at two things, stream restoration and also just building up a better infrastructure. It was explained in somewhat technical terms during the presentation that as we've had more and more development in Mecklenburg County, we have less and less porous space, which makes things like drainage trickier and trickier. So basically the idea is the less porous space you have on your property, the more you might need to pay a little bit in order to account for the fact that you're making that drainage trickier and trickier. Additionally, fee increases were also brought up for parks and rec, things like renting a baseball diamond or a synthetic field at a county park, American Legion Memorial Stadium. Parks and rec staff told commissioners it's simply just been a while since they looked at those fees. A lot of those amenities have been improved since the last time the fees were raised, and that these new fees, even though it would be a 20% increase, are still going to be lower than a lot of surrounding counties comparable.
They're proposing a 20% increase this year and a 20% increase again next year. Who pays these fees, these recreation fees?
So these are fees basically paid by people who want to use these facilities. If you, you know, WFAE wants to have a staff kickball tournament and rent out a baseball diamond at a county park, this is the fee that you guys would pay. If a nonprofit wants to rent out American Legion Memorial Stadium for an event, this is basically the rental fee that you pay. There's also some field maintenance fees that could go up. So if you're getting, for example, a softball field at a county park and you actually want them to come out and draw the baselines, your fee for that's also going to go up 20%.
So I mentioned that the stormwater services fee might increase by 9 to 39 cents, and you mentioned that the solid waste department wants to raise its residential availability fee, whatever that is, by $5. First of all, what does that fee cover, and is that $5 a month, or is that $5 total for the year?
I believe it is monthly, and basically that is a fancy word for the fee that everybody who owns property pays for things like recycling pickup. The fees for disposal would not be going up for residents, and also the fee that county residents pay when they want to use a dump or a landfill that's county owned would also stay flat.
Okay. We have two updates to talk about. One is about the death of a 12-year-old boy early in February at the Trails Carolina Wilderness Camp in western North Carolina. This is a camp for troubled young people. What new information, Nick, do you have about this incident?
Yeah, for the first time, we're getting a look at kind of what happened or some of what happened leading up to that 12-year-old boy dying. This was contained in a new inspection report released by the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. And that report includes excerpts of interviews with the four staff members who were inside the cabin where that boy died that evening. And the biggest takeaway is that the staff member responsible for checking on that boy, who is essentially locked in a bivy sack, which is kind of like a small tent, sleeping bag hybrid, acknowledged that he did not check on the boy like he was supposed to, or in the manner that he was supposed to, throughout the evening. And both that staff member and another staff member speculated that he probably suffocated inside this bivy sack.
The camp was initially reported to have been uncooperative with both authorities and the media. Preliminary reports indicated the death was not natural, and this seems to confirm that if he suffocated, but the medical examiner's report really is still pending. The camp was closed. Any chance that it will ever reopen?
It could. So it remains closed now, and they extended that kind of indefinitely, the period which it could not admit new campers. There was a kind of a conference as part of this process. There's now a meeting between the camp and the DHHS regulators that happened Tuesday, I believe. It's possible. I don't know. I'm not sure I'd say it's probable. I don't know. But the camp, you know, as part of this process, did respond to each of the findings from regulators with how it would address and change things moving forward. It is worth noting the camp's response to each of the individual deficiencies cited, which all seem, you know, generally would seem to be things that you're like, why did they do that? But the camp noted in almost every time, these are things that had previously been approved by regulators. So we have questions for DHHS on that front as well.
Okay. We also have an update on the case of Madalena Kojakari, who disappeared nearly a year and a half ago now. Her stepfather appeared in court to defend himself, I believe, last Friday. Joe, you were there. What happened?
It was a quick appearance. There's a superseding indictment, so he was forced to reappear in court. It's been 522 days since his stepdaughter, Madalena Kojakari, was last seen. He is not saying anything. He is not saying if he is worried about her. He's not saying if he knows where she is. And it's a very frustrating case for everyone. As of now, he is just charged with failure to report her disappearance. He is due back in court on May 20th for a jury trial.
So when you say he's not saying anything, he's not saying not only anything in court, but you asked Christopher Palmander for a comment and he chose not to speak?
Correct. And I mean, he isn't talking to law enforcement either. Law enforcement, Cornelius police have expressed their displeasure with the amount of cooperation they have gotten from Diana Kochikari, his wife, and him.
So he has pleaded not guilty to a charge of failure to report a child who has disappeared. That's what he's charged with. That's what the trial will be about next month.
Correct.
And earlier police said this was not yet a cold case, but it's been a year and a half. Do they still believe that?
As of last check, yes. It's not like they're doing media updates every single week on this. They still are gatekeeping a lot of information, but they are still working under the belief that Madalena is alive.
And what is the status of Madalena's mother, who is also in jail awaiting something, a trial or hearings or something, correct?
Correct. She remains in jail on that same charge. However, a future court date has not been set for her.
A week or so ago, the UNC Board of Governors Committee voted to repeal a policy requiring all public universities in the state to have diversity, equity, and inclusion offices. That was a recommendation by the full board, by the committee, but the full board has yet to act on it. So has there been reaction among faculty and students and staff? What has that reaction been, Steve?
I think it's mostly been concern from the faculty. They feel like the DEI programs are important to, you know, have a strong university. But, you know, as you said, Mike, there'll be a final vote on this in May. And then in the legislature, there's been talk that that the state may move and to dismantle DEI programs in state government as well. So this is just the beginning.
This was voted on by this committee in less than 4 minutes with no discussion, and WUNC reported that Wade Mackey, the head of the UNC System's faculty assembly and a professor at UNCG, said that he's hearing responses to this from both sides of the argument, but that just about everybody on both sides of the argument agrees that the process used was problematic. Will that matter in the end when this comes to a vote of the board, the process?
That's a good question. I would assume no. I mean, perhaps they might slow it down a little bit, but yes, 4 minutes is incredibly fast for something as important as this. But at the end of the day, I don't think that's going to derail the ultimate plan, which is to dismantle DEI.
So, Joe, you reported this week that the federal government, after extensive investigations by the DEA and the IRS, is charging five Chinese nationals with money laundering involving Charlotte banks. Fill us in.
Pretty crazy story. There was a ringleader of this operation who would essentially communicate with the Mexican drug cartels, pick up their money, and have one of their couriers deposit that money into Charlotte area banks.
So the banks were
a University City, Bank of America, Bank of America on Albemarle Road. There's like a Chase Bank up in Huntersville. And we're talking about millions of dollars over a period of about 20 months.
Do we know if the banks were unaware of this activity or unaware of the source of this activity?
The banks cooperated with the investigation. I'm sure they were a little suspicious with frequent deposits of $150,000 at a time.
This next story is national and a little inside baseball, but one with ramifications for almost every city in the country and maybe a lot of employees. Well, heck, definitely a lot of employees, particularly those in broadcasting, but other industries as well. The Federal Trade Commission now says employers can no longer stop their employees from going to work for other companies. Essentially, they struck down non-compete clauses in contracts, which are prevalent, at least in our industry. But now the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is suing the FTC. Why did the FTC make this move in the first place?
Well, they said that rule was anti-worker, and they think rescinding, or, you know, not a lot, stopping non-competes could help increase wages. I mean, basically, if I wanted to go work with Joe at WSOC, I would have to wait a year out of television before I could go do that under my current contract. My bosses are listening. I'm not thinking of that. And but now I could go right over if I wanted to.
Well, red flags, come red Nick. Flags everywhere. That's Nick Oxner, who works currently at WBTV, Joe Bruno with WSOC-TV, Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and political reporter for WFAE News, Steve Harrison. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.